This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to begin today with a discussion about race. And there was news just this afternoon about a police shooting that underscores the relevance of this discussion. In this case, two Cleveland police officers who last year fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was holding a toy gun, will not be indicted. That decision came today from a grand jury. Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Timothy McGinty said Tamir was drawing the replica weapon from his waistband when he was shot. He called the shooting a perfect storm of human error, but he said no crime was committed.
The death of Tamir Rice was an absolute tragedy. It was horrible, unfortunate, and regrettable. But it was not by the law that binds us a crime.
The community and the nation will now debate this decision, but what's not under debate is that it's the latest in a long series of police-involved shootings that is sharpening a national conversation about race in America. And it's having a profound effect on the way we think about race. Just after the election of President Obama, a Wall Street Journal NBC poll found that more than three-quarters of Americans, of those polled, said that race relations in the country were fairly good or very good. But the most recent poll on the same question finds that today just one-third of Americans and only one-quarter of African Americans see race that way. So we're going to begin today with the latest in our end-of-year conversations, this one about the state of race in America and here in Boston. And to help us do that is Peniel Joseph. He's a friend of the program. He's founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. He's also a professor of history at Tufts. And Peniel Joseph, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, this news out of Cleveland, which we actually didn't expect, I'd love to just get your reaction to it. But here, this is a case for listeners that don't remember. 12-year-old Tamir Rice, he was holding a replica gun. Someone had called 911. The cops showed up. Apparently, the prosecutor said he was probably reaching to hand over the gun. But as far as the grand jury was concerned, it was sufficient cause for the cops to shoot him down.
Yeah, not surprised at the outcome in this case, Anthony, because this prosecutor always let it be known that he didn't necessarily think, he gave hints that this was a crime. He felt that it was tragic, but he didn't necessarily think that the officers involved had committed a crime. Now, the way in which the black community and Black Lives Matter activists and folks in Cleveland field, I think, is much different.
Yeah. And express that a little bit. How is this viewed?
Well, I think this is viewed as a series, the latest in a series of police shootings against young African-American, in this case, men, but there's also a lot of women and girls, where there's no recourse, where these folks have not been armed. Maybe there's been some kind of misunderstanding or mischaracterization of them as being some kind of threat. Even though Tamir Rice was 12, he was, over 200 pounds. He was a big kid. Right. The one officer described being really scared by this young black boy. So I think that it's the latest in a series of events that we've seen from Chicago to Cleveland to Ferguson, Missouri, where there's this series of police shootings of unarmed African Americans.
Yeah. I want to ask you about this poll that we mentioned, this Wall Street Journal NBC poll, which really has found this precipitous decline in the way people view the state of race in America. And we mentioned just after the election of Barack Obama, more than three quarters of the folks polled said, you know, things are going pretty well. And, you know, today, not surprisingly, especially after that litany of police shootings that you just described, much different attitude about race. So do you think that race relations in America are evolving, devolving? What's your view?
Well, I think we're coming to terms with 50 years after the Voting Rights Act, 150 years after the end of slavery. We're just coming to terms in 2015 with these different contradictions that we have in terms of America as a society. We have an African-American president, First Lady. At the same time, places like Chicago have huge rates of black violence in terms of black folks who are victims of homicide, huge rates of poverty. Public school segregation right now is at the highest point it's been since 1973, the early 1970s. So a lot of the inequality that I think we thought went away with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and with passage of the Voting Rights Act continue to haunt us. And I think all the protests that we've seen, especially around the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. is very intriguing, because criminal justice system is a gateway to racial and economic oppression in the United States. So we think about this year has been extraordinary because we've seen so many different protests surrounding the criminal justice system, whether it's Charleston, South Carolina, whether it's Chicago, and we've even seen different literary events, the publication of Between the World and Me becoming a bestseller by the journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates. Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow is always a constant source of conversation. So I think race relations have evolved, and I think in 2015, we're getting back to a kind of searingly honest conversation about race that we had in the 1960s.
Mm. I'm glad you brought up Ta-Nehisi Coates, because I wanted to mention this to you. You know, it's been quite a year for him. I mean, he won the National Book Award, Genius Award. He put out this terrific book, Between the World and Me, which he wrote in the form of a letter to his son, and really an effort to sort of make sense of the racial justice in America and what it means to live in America as a black person in 2015. So let's listen to just a little clip of him. Here he is talking to Michelle Martin of NPR.
There are two burdens of racism in this country. The first is the actual burden, you know, sort of socioeconomics that, you know, we see all the time, wealth gap, life expectancy. But then there's another portion of this that folks ask you to accept, and that is, you know, the notion that somehow this is not really tied to our long history, our 350, almost 400-year history of policy directed towards African Americans, that, you know, somehow this is our fault. Between the World and Me is my complete rejection of that idea. It may well be our responsibility, but it certainly is not our fault.
So, Peniel, here's my question about this. You know, and by the way, he goes on and this famous line, or it's, I think it's going to become famous. Here is what I would like for you to know, he says to his son. In America, it is traditional to destroy the black body. It is heritage. So really strong words about this issue. But I want to ask you this, because given this recognition that he's had from the MacArthur Foundation, from the National Book Award, what does it say that a piece of writing like this is so highly regarded and gets so much attention? I mean, that would seem hopeful to me.
Well, yeah, I think it is hopeful. I think we're mainstreaming discussion of both racial justice and racial inequality in the United States. Mm. I think this is connected to Ferguson. It's connected to Eric Garner in Staten Island. It's connected to President Obama speaking out very forcefully this year about racial inequality at the federal prison in Oklahoma.
And first president to do that, right? To go into
president,
a federal penitentiary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the eulogy in South Carolina, in Charleston. Mm. So I think all these things created a perfect storm where we finally were talking about racial inequality. And certainly the street demonstrations, the Black Lives Matter movement forced Bernie Sanders to have a racial justice platform. Martin O'Malley and former Senator Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, to really have a racial justice platform. So I think in a way, this is about social movements, a literary talent in terms of Coates, but also politics all merging together.
Mm. So does that sort of leave you, as we sort of draw the curtain on 2015 and open the curtain on a new year, feeling a little bit more optimistic that we're at least going in the right direction on matters of race?
Well, I'm always optimistic in the sense that I think that young people and people who are trying to read and raise their social political justice consciousness are always the people who are going to be at the cutting edge of whatever new movements and policy implementations we need. So I think the new activism we see has been very hopeful. And one thing we should add is that it's been multiracial. Even mm-hmm. though we call it Black Lives Matter, there's been tons of young white people in the streets and Latinos and Asian Americans and also LGBT activists in the streets. So that movement is about more than just black people, even as I think quite rightly it calls itself a Black Lives Matter movement, because a black life has been so imperiled in our politics, in our policy, in our contemporary historical context.
I want to come back to President Obama. You mentioned that he's been speaking very forcefully about this. He spoke in an interview just last week with NPR's Steve Inskeep about race relations and really what it means to the black family. And here's what he said.
There's no black family that hasn't had a conversation around the kitchen table about driving while black and being profiled or being stopped. I think really what's changed over the last several years is the pervasiveness of smartphones and the visuals that suddenly have sparked a conversation about how we can deal with it.
See, I find that statement interesting for a couple of reasons, but chief among them, the sort of this idea that it's the smartphones that sort of put a spotlight on this. I mean, is that true? Or, I mean, is this a problem that's just always been there and that suddenly we're just finding a new way to identify it?
Well, I think the problem has been historic and longstanding, but certainly the new technology has forced us all to confront it, especially the mainstream. I think the interesting thing about social media, and I call social media the fifth estate, is that it really has forced a different narrative into all of our lives. You know, there are some older people, including African Americans, who I think were initially put off by Black Lives Matter activists and say, mm-hmm. what are they so angry about? Especially middle class and upper middle class African American elites. And as this started to really snowball and you see these incidents happening all over the country, people could no longer ignore it. And so I think the interesting thing about what the president is saying, and I think, again, for 2015, Obama has been very, very forceful in terms of talking about racial justice and racial inequality, is that without these smartphones and without this new kind of leverage and evidence, we would not be having this discussion. Chicago is a great example. With the video of the young man who was mentally troubled, who was shot by an officer, released a year later, the Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff of President Obama, is really under siege in Chicago because people see visual evidence. Young man stumbling away. Officers said a whole different narrative, but the visual shows us that that young man should not have been shot like that.
I also want to come back. You mentioned how Black Lives Matter has really helped influence the presidential race, and Bernie Sanders has been talking about it. Hillary Clinton, I think, had a meeting with some of them. Yeah. But here's Donald Trump, the GOP frontrunner. He's reacting to a Black Lives Matter protester at one of his rallies in Birmingham, Alabama this past November. Here's how that went.
Do I hear somebody over there? You know, you have one guy over there shouting. We have thousands of people, and you'll read about him tomorrow. They'll say, oh, the room had a picket. All right, yeah, get him the hell out of here, will you, please? Get him out of here. Throw him out.
So throw him out. And, of course, Donald Trump also making a lot of headlines with statements about barring Muslim immigration in this country. What's he tapping into with that kind of comment?
Well, he's definitely tapping into a strain of white nationalism, a strain of racism that we've seen nationally. I mean, we can go back to 1948 and Strom Thurmond runs as a segregationist on a Dixiecrat platform and gets 3 million votes. By 68, George Wallace runs as a segregationist in 1968 and gets 9 million votes. A lot of those votes were consolidated with Ronald Reagan in 1980-84. Over the last 30 years, many of the white working class, non-college educated voters have really not voted. They really feel the Republicans are an elite group that has monopolized that party, and they feel Democrats are giving away goods and services to minorities and immigrants. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump has, paradoxically, as a plain-speaking billionaire who's ready to offend all kinds of constituencies, right. immigrants, women, blacks, just poor people, he's become their champion. So you've got on social media and chat lines, white supremacist groups who are openly saying Donald Trump is our champion, and the voice of a disaffected white male who's angry about Obamacare. They're angry about rising white unemployment. The white unemployment rate, especially for non-college educated whites, is soaring. They're angry about being left behind, and they feel that Donald Trump is their champion.
Hmm. I want to bring this conversation back home to Boston for a particular reason. You're a professor at Tufts University, but you're going to be leaving the Boston area, which I only learned about today. And I'm happy for you because it sounds like a great move. You're heading to a new job at the University of Texas in Austin.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But you know, with regard to race in this city, I think there's a sense here that things are better today than they were at one time. But what's your experience been here? I mean, are people a little too comfortable with the idea that the city has made progress? What's your feeling about this city?
Well, I think this city has made tremendous progress. I think we've got people like Ayanna Presley in the city council. We have Tito Jackson. We have so many different politicians. At Harvard, we've got Skip Gates. We've got so many different people of note in this city. But this city has a long way to go in terms of we still have never had an African-American mayor of this city. We have a long way to go about in terms of getting equity in terms of black businesses in this city. We are the capital of higher education in the United States. We, you know, the students at Tufts, at Harvard, at Brandeis have been protesting, saying they want more faculty, staff, students, but also administrators and board of trustees of color. And they want the billions of dollars that higher education generates to actually be spread out to communities of color in the Boston area. Segregation. We have a very tough, difficult history with public school and residential segregation in Boston. The new Boston on one level is more racially integrated, but it's so predicated on class and who has access and who doesn't to be part of these new self-selected, integrated, gentrified communities. Cambridge is a great example of that. Cambridge, you'll have wonderful pockets of racial integration, but it's all based on having access. So Boston has a long way to go. And when we think about gentrification in Boston and transforming neighborhoods, it can't be about displacing residents who have no ownership in those neighborhoods and bringing in young people who are very, on some levels, open-minded, but have so much money and so much access that they're not even realizing that in transforming these neighborhoods, they're actually displacing residents instead of having lower-income residents who might not look like them as their new neighbors.
All right. Well, that's Peniel Joseph talking about the state of race in the nation and here in Boston. Progress has been made, but the road ahead is long. Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, on his way to the University of Texas in Austin. Peniel, always a pleasure. Good luck. Happy New Year, and have a great year.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. A lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.